With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The group that backed the voter-approved medical marijuana ballot question wants to compromise with the state on implementing the program. The state and legislative leaders want the summer to work on the program with a goal of implementing it in July of 2022. Medical marijuana proponents say the program needs to start months earlier. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
The Department of Health is tasked with drafting rules for a medical marijuana program. Although voted on in November, the medical marijuana measure was written before the coronavirus pandemic. Medical cannabis backers say they agree delaying the implementation of the program is justified. However, they say the state should have about a year to put a program in place, not a year and a half or longer. South Dakotans for Better Marijuana Laws is proposing the compromise. They also say prospective patients should be allowed to possess and cultivate cannabis starting July 1st of this year. Matthew Schweik is with the Marijuana Policy Project, which helped with the campaign on Initiative Measure 26. He says the current bill freezes what 70% of South Dakotans approved, then empowers an interim committee to rewrite the law.
And that's not our approach. Our approach is to implement Measure 26 as written, while providing flexibility for the legislature to extend deadlines further if absolutely necessary.
2 weeks ago, Governor Kristi Noem and Republican legislative leaders announced a plan to delay implementation of Initiative Measure 26. Gary Kamak is the majority leader in the Senate. He says the legislature wants to get the program implemented.
To make sure that we do it safely and correctly the first time, and that's the only reason we're asking for the flexibility for the additional time.
House lawmakers are expected to vote on the bill sometime this week. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
Two bills designed to help victims of childhood sexual abuse seek legal action have failed in a House committee. One bill would have overturned the statute of limitations for civil suits involving childhood sexual abuse. The other aimed to let child sex abuse victims sue organizations. Current state law says a survivor has to file civil action within 3 years or before they turn 40. Representative Perry Poirier introduced the bills. She says South Dakota law restricts survivors' ability to seek justice through the courts.
Why don't we send the message that we're going to protect our children no matter who you are? And if that child, that 6-year-old, that 7-year-old, grows up and finally gets to a level of healing where they start remembering things, that they can reach and search in the event there's an entity that is at play here, they need to be held accountable.
Similar attempts to change state law have failed in the past. Critics say the current statute of limitations for child sex crimes is sufficient for survivors. Justin Bell is a lobbyist for St. Joseph's Indian School.
Based off of the statute of limitations, at some point, it simply is not fair to litigate a case when a defendant has no records and can call no witnesses to prove its case because they are likely destroyed based off of the passage of time or the perpetrators and witnesses have deceased.
Bell says removing age limits would harm organizations like schools or churches over the actions of former members. Francine Charbonneau supports the bills. She and her 8 sisters say they were sexually abused at the St. Paul Indian Mission on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in the 1950s and 1960s.
But you know what? The state of South Dakota, they closed the box on us, and we're still squirming to get our voices heard. It's kind of a dirty shame. But I can sleep at night. I wonder if they can.
The committee rejected the two bills by deferring them to the end of the session. I'm John Wynn, now back to In the Moment.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Vaccine distribution and administration continues to accelerate in South Dakota. There are different lanes of vaccination for residents of the state. Sanford, Avera, and Monument Health have administered tens of thousands of vaccines. The Veterans Administration is now vaccinating veterans 50 and older. Indian Health Services is working quickly to vaccinate tribal community members. And now pharmacies join the efforts as well, as South Dakota seeks to vaccinate people 65 and older. Joining us for an update on how you can get your vaccine through Hy-Vee Pharmacies in Sioux Falls, we welcome Christina Gaiman, Director of Public Relations for Hy-Vee. Welcome back, Christina. Thanks for being here.
Lori. Thanks for having me.
Tell us an overview of how the vaccine rollout is working at Hy-Vee pharmacies.
So we are receiving a CDC allocation. We were named a federal partner with them a few weeks ago, and we're receiving that throughout South Dakota, specifically in the Sioux Falls area. Watertown has been a recipient, and then Vermilion, and we're hoping to kind of roll that out to additional locations over time, obviously. But right now, our Sioux Falls pharmacies in particular have hundreds of COVID-19 vaccines that are available for scheduling. You must schedule your appointment in advance via our website, Hy-Vee.com, and then at the top there's a banner about COVID-19 vaccines, and you can click on that and it'll take you right through to where you can find an appointment. And for us, we are obviously prioritizing those ages 65 and older along with state guidance, but there are some additional eligibility groups per South Dakota state guidance right now that are open to also be vaccinated. So we're also able to vaccinate law enforcement officials, correctional officers, high-risk patients, so people who might be on dialysis, are post-transplant, or an active cancer patient, and then also anyone who's considered high-risk in a congregate setting or residents in licensed independent living facilities, as well as residents of licensed group homes. So there are quite a few categories of eligible individuals in South Dakota that we are able to vaccinate at our retail pharmacies right now.
So you go to Hy-Vee.com and you put in a variety of information. How fast are those appointments going? Are they, proactive, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. How proactive do you have to be in getting one of those slots?
You know, I think, you know, so this is our kind of second week of the program. The first week they went super quick, right? Because there hadn't really been much vaccine in the state yet. Specifically in some areas where Hy-Vee is. And so I would say those appointments went in fewer than 4 hours. But we received these allocations late yesterday. And so we do have, you know, several hundred openings still. And so we just want to make sure that we're getting the word out and letting people know a Hy-Vee pharmacy is a location that you can look for on our website in your area to see if we have vaccine. And we are expecting to get regular weekly allocations through the CDC partnership.
For people who are wondering, if at the end of the day somebody didn't show up and you have extra vaccines that you need to distribute, can they walk in and get lucky?
We do not encourage that because there is no way to know if we will have extra vaccine A. We try not to do that. Obviously, if someone cancels an appointment unexpectedly or just doesn't show up, we may have a couple of extra doses at the course of the day. And what we're doing is either calling people from the following day's appointments and seeing if they want to come in early to try to get them in as quickly as possible. Or in some cases, our stores do have wait lists. So if you've tried to get an appointment, and let's just say all of your locations near you are full, a lot of our pharmacies are putting people on a wait list if they are in that current eligibility group. And then as they have a situation that maybe comes up like that, they would then go to that wait list to contact those individuals to come on in.
If you are not sure if you are a high-risk person, how do you confirm that you can sign up and then get the shot to, you know, when you come in for it?
You know,
what
the,
does high-risk confirmation look like?
The state is being very specific in what that guidance is. So right now, the state of South Dakota says high-risk patients include those on dialysis, those who are post-transplant, and those who are active cancer patients. And then, so that's high-risk patients, and then anyone high-risk in a congregate setting, which includes residents in licensed independent living facilities and residents of licensed group homes. So that's kind of the two high-risk categories and explanations that the state has provided on their website. And so that's what we are also sharing with our Facebook fans, followers, our store customers. You know, if you're part of these groups that the state has outlined, you can be vaccinated at Hy-Vee.
Christina Gaiman is Director of Public Relations for Hy-Vee. That website, again, is Hy-Vee.com. You can find all our vaccine coverage on our website at sdpb.org/news. Christina, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thanks, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to talk about how the politics of the past impacts how campaigns are run, as author Mark C. Johnson tells us about his book, Tuesday Night Massacre. But first, the politics of today. This legislative session, In the Moment, is bringing you inside the rooms where decisions are made in peer. Today, in their own words, listens in to the House State Affairs Committee as committee members consider House Bill 1245 that would reduce the time period for absentee voting.
My name is Steve Haugard, District 10 Representative, here on behalf of House Bill 1245. House Bill 1245 is pretty straightforward. It's to simply modify the statute in regard to absentee voting. It reduces the time period from 46 days down to 30 days. The point of that is simply to give everyone an opportunity to probably hear more of the information that's being presented in any given election cycle. And I think what we've all experienced is you see how at least candidates and committees in regard to ballot measures and so on, how they focus their message to probably spend more time toward the end of the election cycle and to get more of the information out. And so I think it helps to focus the election to acquiring the most information for the voter without taking away the opportunity to actually absentee vote. Those individuals who choose to vote absentee have a reduced period from 46 down to 30 days. You know, you talk about some of the advantages of absentee voting, which would be voter convenience and satisfaction, potential financial savings, potential turnout. You also look at the downside of some of those issues. Most people, hopefully, are studying the issues before they get to the polling place. And so the idea that they would sit at home and have a better opportunity there, I don't think is really a viable argument. I think that the voters presumably are looking at the issues and considering their options well in advance of the time that they go to the polls. And so you'd want for the voters to not only be well informed, but take it very, very seriously. You know, across the country now we're talking about options for online voting. And that's, I think, diminishes the significance of the whole process down to the point where this is just an afterthought. And it shouldn't be. It should be one of the most profound things that we do as members of a republic. And also there are concerns about whether or not the voter fully understands the process when they're at home. If they're at the polling place, they have an opportunity to ask questions. And also there's a concern, and I think a lot of us have at least heard anecdotes or know of in individual situations where there have been opportunities for coercion. And I think about the nursing home settings or elderly family members that are oftentimes influenced by other members in the household. So that's a concern as well. And then the idea of mail-out ballots. If you look at the lower income spectrum, oftentimes individuals in that situation will be moving on a regular basis. And I think you can see that in South Dakota on reservations in particular. There are oftentimes shared mailboxes, and I don't think that's ensures any kind of integrity within the voting process, or that the ballots will actually be delivered to the person they're intended to. So those are some of the pros and cons. The idea of shortening the time is, like I say, to focus the issue down to the importance of the election itself. And we should have such a high regard for the election process that we don't want to diminish that.
We'll move on to opponent testimony for House Bill 1245. I know we have a couple online, but we'll start with who's in the room.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, morning. Members of the committee. Steve Barnett, Secretary of State for the great state of South Dakota. We're here today in opposition of House Bill 1245. We have concerns over tightening the time frame for our state's voters to cast ballots in our elections. The current 46-day absentee voting period has been in place since 2013, when it was increased from 45 days. The additional day was to account for the potential of the required 45-day UOCAVA requirement falling on a weekend. UOCAVA voters are uniform and overseas citizens covered under federal UOCAVA absentee voting laws. South Dakotans have had at least a 42-day absentee period since 1985. In closing, our office believes that the current absentee time frame has worked well for our state. We have received no complaints from voters concerning the absentee period being too long. Nothing requires our citizens to cast their vote early. Instead, they can choose at what point during the absentee period they'd like to vote or wait to cast their ballot on Election Day. I think some of the most informed voters are going to vote early. A lot of them will cast their ballot and then maybe head down south. I don't think they're waiting for a newspaper ad or a postcard to come in the mail. So, again, thanks for your time this morning. Our office will stand by for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. For their opening testimony, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Roger Tellinghuesen, a registered lobbyist for the South Dakota Association of County Officials, which includes the registers of deed, treasurers, and auditors, who are your local election officials. And out of the 66 auditors in South, or 65 auditors in South Dakota, 31 of them responded in an email, if you will, to our office here in Pierre, and not one of them supports this bill. And there's one particular email that I would like to read to you, if I could, because I think it really encapsulates the opposition to this bill. And that's from Kathy Glines, who's the auditor in Harding County. She says, House Bill 1245 modifies the time period for absentee voting from 46 days to 30 days prior to the election. I would please ask that you consider the following. Looking back at the 2020 calendar, those 46 days, when you subtract the weekends and holidays, actually left 31 days for the primary and 30 days for the general that the voters actually had access to the county auditor's office for absentee voting. We are a very rural county, and the majority of our voters only get mail 3 days a week, which is basically limiting to 21 days for the rural people that are relying on the mail for the delivery of the absentee ballot. Going to 30 days will make it extremely tight for ballots to be requested, delivered, and returned. The argument is going to be made that due to the long period of time for absentee voting, that people will change their minds on how they want to vote. We cannot save people from themselves. I've had voters change their minds when voting on Election Day. Elections are not only about the candidates, they're about the voters. Our job is to make sure that everyone gets the chance to vote, that there is integrity in the process, and that the votes get counted. By limiting the time frame of absentee voting, it sends a message that we are not concerned about the voter and their ability to access a ballot. I would compare it to changing the hours that the polling places are open. We are reducing the time frame by 35%. Should we consider reducing the polling hours by 35% also? Instead of the polls being open 12 hours, they would be open 8 hours. And we haven't had problems in the past in South Dakota with absentee voting. We've had record turnouts with absentee voting in this last election. And I think that's indicative of the people's access and ability to vote absentee and participate in the process. That's really what this is about and should be encouraged and not limited further than it is right now.
Following debate and questions, committee members voted 7-6 to refer House Bill 1245 to the 41st legislative day. There is no 41st legislative day, of course, so that bill was defeated, and the number of days available for absentee voting will not change. You can hear complete hearing testimony at SD.net. Follow the South Dakota Legislature link in the meeting archive section. Well, later in the hour, we find inspiration in finding freedom and in building something together. But first, the cost of division. Author Mark C. Johnson explains how the 1980 defeat of U.S. Senator George McGovern and three other Senate Democrats changed forever the way the U.S. Senate does business. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. This is In the Moment. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. Now let's think more deeply about politics and how the politics of the past changes the political landscape of the future. Author Mark Johnson has released a new book that looks at the landmark election of 1980 and how independent expenditure committees like the National Conservative Political Action Committee reinvented how campaigns are run. Specifically, the group capitalized on a loophole in finance campaign finance laws that allow for the expenditure of unlimited amounts of money as long as the committee spending the money doesn't coordinate directly with a candidate. The National Conservative Political Action Committee was formed in 1975 by a group of young up-and-comers like Terry Dolan and Roger Stone, and it used a massive national direct mail fundraising effort to target four liberal Senate incumbents, Frank Church, Birch Bayh, John Culver, and South Dakota's George McGovern. The book is called Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party. I talked with the author about bumper sticker politics, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, known as NCPAC, and how the changing nature of politics in America shifted how the U.S. Senate does business.
Again, one of the pernicious aspects of these independent campaigns is that they could do this kind of nefarious, nasty, hit job type campaigning, and the person who was benefiting from it, in this case, the Republican challengers, tended to be able to say, well, that's not me, that's not my campaign, I'm separate from that. But they could benefit at the same time from having those effective attacks being launched against their opponents. Jim Abner in South Dakota, Dan Quayle, who won the Senate race in Indiana against Birch Bayh in 1980, Steve Sims in South Dakota, or in Idaho, I should say, against Frank Church, all sort of disavowed NCPAC, said, we don't want anything to do with these guys. But again, it's sort of having your cake and eating it too, being able to disavow the effort, but at the same time benefit from the fact that these guys are beating the crap out of your opponent.
So McGovern says in 1979 that the future of the country is at stake here. What does he see as this starts to unfold that gives him the knowledge that, in his opinion at least, there's a whole lot more at stake than just whether George McGovern will go back to Washington?
I think all of these guys, and McGovern and John Culver in Iowa, were perhaps the most eloquent about talking about it, saw that this sort of emotional, anger-driven, grievance-driven politics was really going to, number one, change the nature of politics in America, and profoundly change the way the Senate approached its business. All of these guys are, I would say, were institutionalists when it comes to the Senate. They had a real reverence for the place as an institution where, you know, bipartisanship was to be strived for, not always successfully attained, but there was a real sense that to get things done in the good, for the good of the country, you had to come together on really big things and work together. Civil rights, Vietnam, the issues that had dominated the 1960s and on into the 1970s. We think of that those two decades, particularly the 60s, as being very contentious times, and they were. You know, student unrest on campus, great concern about the war in Vietnam, civil rights protests, assassinations. But at the same time, the Senate accomplished a tremendous amount of lasting import for the country. Passage of a civil rights bill, Medicare was created, public radio and public television were authorized. So immense amount of good was done for the country in that period, even though the political climate was really quite nasty in many respects. But that sense of bipartisanship, that sense that a George McGovern could from South Dakota could work with a Republican like Bob Dole from Kansas and create the food stamp program, for example, that Birch Bayh could work on a bipartisan basis to create legislation to make it possible for colleges and universities to have patents on inventions that were created as part of academic research, that Frank Church could work across the aisle with John Sherman Cooper, a Republican from Kansas or from Kentucky, to try to bring about an end to the war in Vietnam. So there was a real sense of this kind of reverence for the institution. And I think McGovern in particular, John Culver in particular, said, you know, it's going to make it really difficult to work across the aisle if we let every one of these campaigns become a death grudge match between the parties. There is just not going to be much basis for cooperation if that's the way we're going to conduct ourselves politically.
And in many ways, you could argue he was right, that it's very difficult.
Yeah, I would argue he very much was right, that the Senate has changed a lot. You know, one of the big issues in the late 1970s that carried on into these 80 campaigns was the effort to ratify the Panama Canal treaties, the effort to return sovereignty of the Panama Canal to Panama, an issue that dated back to at least the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. Every president from Eisenhower to Jimmy Carter, who finally signed the Panama Canal treaties, advocated for the return of the canal sovereignty to Panama, in part because tens of thousands of American military personnel were stationed in Panama, not just to protect the canal, but to protect the canal from Panama, Panamanians. A real concern that, you know, this operations of the canal would be jeopardized because there was such unrest about the United States essentially controlling this vital resource in a sovereign nation. So the canal treaties pass on a bipartisan basis. One of the biggest supporters on the Republican side was Howard Baker, the Republican leader of the Senate from Tennessee, but it passed on a bipartisan basis. But Richard Viguerie, Terry Dolan, these leading lights of the new right really saw this as a powerful emotional issue that could be weaponized in a way to go after these incumbents who had supported the treaty. And of course, all of these Democrats supported the treaty. They pounded on it for year after year, even though the issue was gone and decided, they continued to pound on it as a very divisive issue in these 1980 elections. The irony, of course, is that 40 years on, the United States has had quite good relations with Panama. The Panama Canal has been enlarged and improved under Panamanian sovereignty. It's not been an issue where we have to worry about the operations of the canal. The people who predicted that the United States, in essence, doing the right thing and returning sovereignty to Panama would ensure the long-term success of the canal have been proven right. They got kicked around pretty badly on a political basis for doing that in the late 1970s and 1980.
The cry to insult somebody for wanting to give away the canal sounds, in its messaging, it has a cleanliness or a clarity to it that a Build the Wall campaign does. Talk just a little bit about the hyper focus on one issue that maybe is way more complex than three or four words. How do we see that today, that kind of messaging and that the focus of it still being a really successful political tool to get votes in spite of it really, by and large, being an incredibly complex topic that can't be summed up in three or four words?
Right. Give away the Panama Canal fits on a bumper sticker. Baby killer fits on a bumper sticker. McGovern and Church, Birch Bayh, were all accused of being baby killers because in some cases they had a pretty nuanced position on abortion. Frank Church, for example, in Idaho, long called himself an anti-abortion Democrat, a pro-life Democrat. His position was essentially the same as the Mormon Church position on abortion, but he was attacked for being unwilling to support an anti-abortion amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Same issue with Senator McGovern in South Dakota. So a very emotional issue, a very complicated issue, a nuanced issue that can be reduced to just a handful of words, made to be the focus of grievance or anger on the part of people who are receiving that message. And it can be a very, very powerful thing. And I think it has become the essence of political messaging today. It is the essence, I would argue, of Republican messaging today. There's an anger and a grievance in so much of the dialogue that you hear from Republican members of Congress about all kinds of things. And public policy, with all due respect to people on the political right, is a complicated business. You know, determining healthcare policy or energy policy or transportation policy is not a simple matter. It's not able to, you're not able to reduce it to, you know, a catchy slogan. Or if you do, you simplify it to the point of distortion. And that's what happened with a lot of these issues that were too complicated to be treated in such a cavalier fashion.
I wanted to ask you, and this isn't something that you particularly covered in your book, but I'm curious to hear your opinion on it, and that is the role of the media as an opponent. When we talk about a strategy of really starting early, I think of Governor Kristi Noem in South Dakota, who lately has been, you know, very vocal about how the media treats her. And sometimes I think if she had an opponent for governor in 2022, she would have someone else to talk about. But it seems sometimes like the media or journalists are the opponent, the political opponent, the enemy. How does the media and journalistic coverage sort of evolve during this time that we're seeing the results of today?
Well, that is a wonderful and profound question that I think a lot of us who care about journalism and the future of information that allows people to make political decisions, informed political decisions, are really worried about, frankly. And again, I see some of the seeds of this sort of journalism being the enemy of politicians in this 1980 period. One of the news organizations that was most aggressive in covering NCPAC and its tactics was the Idaho Statesman newspaper in Boise, Idaho, the capital city of Idaho, where I lived for a long time. That became an issue in the campaign. NCPAC had bumper stickers printed up that said, "I'm voting for Steve Sims, the Statesman made me do it," as though the newspaper was part of the discussion of the political campaign. That was maybe an early indicator of the fact that there's a market for at least some people in American politics to make hay by attacking the messenger, so to speak, the person or people or institutions that are trying to provide insight into what's going on, to provide accountability to people in public office. You know, easy to make them the target of these kinds of attacks. I think it's enormously dangerous. I think it's requiring a new level of engagement on the part of so many journalists and news organizations who have to tiptoe through this minefield of trying to provide a solid, fact-based, as objective as they possibly can be, assessment of issues and personalities, and at the same time being the focus a lot of times of attacks by those very same personalities. So it's an enormously complicated thing. For a long time, and I was guilty of this as a reporter myself, I think journalists for a long time thought of covering politics as a he said, she said kind of story, that you report on what candidate A says, and then you get candidate B's response to that. That kind of reporting, it seems to me, is really woefully inadequate these days, because it just does not get to the essence of what is really happening most of the time. So I see some real changing of that approach to do more fact checking, to do more analysis of what people are saying and compare it to positions that they've taken in the past. And I think that's all to the good. At the same time, I can only imagine what folks in your position, Lori, and others are feeling when you become the focus of the story, so to speak, as opposed to the policy or the politician being the focus of the story.
Independents are the fastest growing political party in South Dakota. I'm sure that's not a unique story nationwide, as at least some of those people who are making that decision are frustrated with this kind of lack of bipartisanship or this divisive campaigning. Is there a change on the horizon? Are we just going to be dealing with the kind of legacy of some of these independent expenditure campaigns for the foreseeable future?
Well, I certainly hope so. I try to be an optimist about this, but seeing the last 4 years particularly, and maybe the last decade before that in particular, it's hard to be terribly optimistic that a resilient democracy continues to be resilient when you have as much discord and disdain for facts and basic information as we seem to have right now. You know, when I submitted this book to the publisher, University of Oklahoma Press, the editor suggested, you know, that the subtitle of the book ought to be The Radicalization of the Republican Party. And I thought, well, maybe that's going too far. You know, I had suggested something like The Decline of American Democracy. And they argued that, no, you've really told the story here of how a political party had systematically become radicalized over the last 40 years. And I've thought about that, particularly since the events of January 6th at the nation's capital, when, you know, you see this, it's almost hard to believe still to me, you see these incredible scenes of an insurrectionist mob, many of them supporting white supremacist viewpoints, militia viewpoints, storming the Congress of the United States to try to stop the certification of a free and fair election that in state after state had been certified by local election officials, had been reviewed by judges at every level. To think that some people in the Republican Party are now being condemned by their followers for saying the person who incited those mobs should be held to account gives me pause as to whether we can claw our way out of this cul-de-sac that we seem to find ourselves in. So I don't think radicalization is too big a word to use with what has happened to the GOP in so many ways. The embrace of the big lie that the election was somehow stolen from a Republican president, it really does harken back to some of the big lies that were told in the 1980 campaign against these incumbent Democratic senators. In my mind, it's not hard to see where the kind of grievance-driven, fear-driven, anger-driven politics of the 1980 campaign winds up with blood being spilled on the steps of the United States Capitol.
Tuesday Night Massacre by Mark C. Johnson is available in bookstores this month. You can find the transcript of my complete interview with Johnson and video of our conversation on our website. Head to sdpb.org. Well, in a few moments, we explore the richness of our past with a look at black settlers in South Dakota. But first, it was this week in 1889, during his final days in office, that President Grover Cleveland signed an enabling act. The act paved the way for the creation of four new states, Washington, Montana, and splitting Dakota Territory along the 7th Standard Parallel, North and South Dakota. The act set off a series of events over the next 7 months. Legal residents of the future states voted for state representatives and chose delegates to political conventions. Results of an election for congressional representatives had to be submitted by April 15th. Montana, Washington, and North Dakota were each entitled to one representative in the U.S. House, while South Dakota was allowed two because of its higher population. Sioux Falls was the capital in the months leading to statehood. It's where delegates met to vote for the Constitution or against the Constitution. Revisions were made and resubmitted after each ballot until the majority of delegates agreed on its passing. The newly formed states were expected to pay off the debts of their respective territories, and in return, the federal government would provide education and maintain public schooling system. North and South Dakota delegates met in Bismarck to decide the final borderline between the two states and to decide how they would split territorial public records, debt, and property. Each state was expected to pay for its share of Dakota Territory debt. And then, on November 2, 1889, President Benjamin Harrison signed documents officially admitting the twin states of North and South Dakota into the Union. It's a process set in motion 132 years ago this week with the Enabling Act. Our thanks to Dr. Brad Tennant, Professor of History at Presentation College. Images of the Past is up next. You're with listener-supported In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. In a few moments, we spend time with artist Oliver Jeffers. He's not from South Dakota, but his books help us see ourselves from far away, maybe even from space. But first, a little South Dakota history. The rush of European-American settlers entering Dakota Territory after the Civil War included all kinds of people hoping for a fresh start, and not all of those people had roots in Europe. A small but significant number of Black Americans were among those drawn to the region by various government-backed homestead programs. The lives and times of some of those Black settlers, including those who established a colony of sorts in Sully County, are the subject of today's Images of the Past. You can find more on our website at sdpb.org. But our guest is Rick Edwards. He's Director Emeritus of the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, and he's joining us by phone this morning from Denver. Rick, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
This is a history that a lot of people don't know. How common was it for people of African descent to be part of the homesteading acts in South Dakota or in Dakota Territory?
Well, there were relatively few African Americans who settled in the Dakotas, more in other parts of the Great Plains, in Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, and even New Mexico. In total, of course, they were a small number compared to the vast numbers of white homesteaders. But they formed a significant group, and their history, I think, is important for us to remember. Their significance was not necessarily measured just by the numbers.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about some of the government programs that invited people to come and how different homesteading groups took advantage of that. Like, what is the path to land ownership for these settlers?
Yes. Well, the main act was the Homestead Act of 1862, which Abraham Lincoln signed. Of course, it was in the middle of the Civil War. What's unusual about the Homestead Act was that it contained no racial exclusions or qualifications. So African Americans were eligible to homestead. It did include a provision that people needed to be citizens or intending to become citizens, and that was not clear for Black people until 1866, when a Civil Rights Act, and of course then later the 14th Amendment, indicated that they were clearly citizens. So the territories open in 30 states for homesteading were open to African Americans, and of course their main hopes were to obtain land that they could work in the South. After all, those were fields that they, with their own sweat, had prepared and created and made productive. But land reform in the South was defeated after the Civil War. And so some African Americans turned their eyes west in a migration before the Great Migration to the northern cities. And so they came to South Dakota. So the South Dakota case is very interesting. Norvell Blair was a man born in slavery in Tennessee in the 1840s. After he was freed, he went to Illinois first and was successful as an entrepreneur there. But in 1882, he sent his two sons to Sully County to discover whether that would be a good place for them to settle. The sons returned with a favorable report, and that was really the beginning of Black settlement in Sully County.
Tell me a little bit about the legacy of this today. Is there a historical interpretation? Do we have communities of people who trace their roots back to this migration and this really nationwide distribution of wealth and land? What can you tell me about that?
Yes, it certainly has left a legacy, not so much in terms of communities of Black farmers, but more in the lives of the descendants of Black homesteaders, of whom we estimate there are about 250,000 living today. That's from Black homesteaders across all of the Great Plains states. the Black homesteaders had a great belief in education, and one of the first things they did was to create schools, and they participated actively in those. But as many farm families, Black and white, have found, that when you have children who are educated to be nurses or pharmacists or teachers, it's often hard to keep them on the farm. They want to use their new education and skills someplace, and that's usually in a city. And so these Black communities, just like many, many white homesteader communities, found that their young people left. Now, for the Black homesteading generation, that was okay. Their legacy was not going to be, and they saw this, was not going to be in a multi-generational farm. In some cases, it was, and there are some that for which that was true in Sully County. But mostly it was in creating a space where the homesteading generation could earn their livelihoods and educate their children. And their most generous gift to their children and grandchildren was education, which would allow them to succeed in other places and in other occupations.
Many enslaved people in North America were promised things after the Civil War, you know, promised to, you know, to stay where they were at, and they would be able to get some of that land. Those promises were broken. And in our remaining minute here, I'm just wondering if were these people, did they find the kind of freedom that we would hope they were able to find as they moved on from enslavement and into a brighter tomorrow, not only for them, but for the generation after them?
Yes, I think they did. Of course, American society was marked by racism and segregation right up to the present. And so they had to survive in that kind of society. But there was a great deal of joy and feeling of accomplishment and success in these communities. And I think they found that while the world was not perfect, and certainly they suffered challenges and hardships, these were pretty successful people. And just like their white homesteader neighbors, they accomplished a lot in their lives of which they were very proud.
Rick Edwards is the Director Emeritus of the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska. He joined us for today's Images of the Past, and you can find more on our website at sdpb.org. Rick, thank you so much for your time today. We really, really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Sometimes the things we have put together need to be taken apart, reconsidered, reconstructed. We've spent nearly a year now reimagining our lives within a new framework. Often building that framework has been shadowed by fear and anxiety, but much of what we've rebuilt, we have rebuilt with compassion and a stronger sense of our own fragility and our own community. There is much work left to be done. We close this hour with thoughts from picture book author and illustrator Oliver Jeffers. His latest book is called What We'll Build: Plans for Our Together Future. As an Irishman, he recalibrated his political frustrations by contemplating the astronauts viewing planet Earth from far away. I asked him about living and making art in a swiftly tilting world.
I am naturally an optimist, and I'm filled with hope, and I know there's a lot of fear and anger and aggression that exists in the world at the minute, but I do think it's obvious to everyone and anyone, regardless of where they sit politically, that things cannot continue as they are, and a lot of the systems with which we have always sort of just assumed would be there might not always be there. A lot of the structures and the way in which they were created might not have been created in the best possible way. And it's a time of great change. And while it feels turbulent and it all feels to be happening very, very quickly, I think this is good in that it's all happening at once, so that there can be a period of I think resolution and moving forward, where a new world has a place for everyone, and a different way in which everyone can tell a slightly different story about their own existence and about their own role that they play in a place that everybody's taken care of, that everybody has a part in that story. Well, I think stories are some of the most important things that have ever happened to humanity. It's the way in which that we can unite around something. Like, you know, even nationalism is a story. The stories of cultural identity are a story. Stories of that we tell ourselves of who we are and how we want to be are a story. And something that I've come to realize, and as I was making fine art about this, about the realization of how I viewed Northern Irish politics was the same as the way that astronauts looked at Earth from a distance, is that we are no more than the stories that we tell, the stories that we tell ourselves, that other people tell about us, and the stories that we are told. And that's it. We are a collection of stories.
Thank you for joining us for this particular collection of stories today. We hope that it served you. Here are a few things you might like to know. You can find all our stories online at sdpb.org/news. You can find videos on our YouTube channel. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Instagram, SDPB in the moment. Twitter, @momentSDPB. You can also send us your stories and ideas via email inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Steve Zwemke, Josh Heyer, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.